This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Mike Birbiglia, is a comic, writer, actor, and filmmaker, and a contributor to This American Life, who tells personal stories about the kind of experiences and thoughts many people would not want to reveal out of fear of being embarrassed or judged harshly. Birbiglia has done it again in his new book, The New One, Painfully True Stories from a Reluctant Dad. It's about all the reasons he did not want to become a father, how he became a father in spite of that, and all the reasons why he felt he wasn't connecting to his baby daughter and feared his marriage was falling apart. It didn't fall apart. His wife, Jen Stein, who writes under the name J. Hope Stein, collaborated on his new memoir, contributing her side of the story through poems interspersed through the book. Their daughter, Una, is now 5 years old. The book ends when she's around 14 months. Mike Birbiglia also made and starred in the films Sleepwalk With Me and Don't Think Twice. He had a recurring role in Orange is the New Black and is now in the Showtime series Billions. His new memoir, The New One, is expanded from his stage show of the same name. Mike Birbiglia, Jen Stein, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the new book. I think it's great. So, Mike, how did you fear your life would change if you had children?
Well, one of the interesting things about putting this material on stage is, and a lot of authors say this, is that it's when you write that you understand how you feel. And so I had this resistance from day one with Jen, and really and before that of, you know, I'm never going to have a child. I remember one of my first jokes that ever worked on stage was, I'm not going to have kids until I'm sure that nothing else good can happen in my life. And then when I expounded on that in the show, in the book, I broke it down to 7 reasons why I'd never want to have a child. I, you know, things that include, like, I love my marriage, I love my cat, you know, the earth is sinking into the ocean, all these things. And I just felt so, logically, I felt so correct about all of my reasoning that it really took my wife putting it, I would say, in more emotional terms for me to understand it, which is to say, she heard me out on all those reasons, and she said, I know all of that, and I think you'd be a good dad. And that was sort of a thing that really melted me, because maybe, and I don't know if this is true, maybe underneath all of that was a fear that I wouldn't be a good dad.
But you saw things in your brother's life and in the lives of friends who had children that you didn't want in your life, that you wanted to avoid. What were some of those things that you saw in your peers who were fathers?
It just seemed like, well, my brother Joe, who's been like possibly my best friend and a collaborator for many years, runs my company. He has 2 kids. And, you know, I make the joke in the book. I say he used to be so cool, and now he's a loser. And it's not that he's a loser, but he's just, you know, sort of less able to go out or do anything. It seemed like he was so bound, he was so restricted in this way that I just didn't want to be. And at one point, I said to Joe, what's it like having a kid? And he took a long pause and he thought about it and he said, it's relentless. And then he said, I'm not worried about you, because if you have a kid, it's not going to be better or worse. It's just going to be new. And that's sort of where the title of the show and the book came from, which is The New One.
Jen, when it... from Mike's telling, when you and he decided to get married, you agreed that you didn't want to have children. But Jen, you changed your mind about that. So give us the short version of why you didn't think you wanted to have children, but then changed your mind.
I guess it wasn't something I was really thinking about. When we met and we got married, it was almost kind of a goof because we had been dating a while. It had been pretty tumultuous, but we really loved each other. And then we were like, let's just get married. And we eloped. And And my mom, like, we called my parents, and my stepfather thought it was a joke when we called and said that we got married. And my grandmother assumed I was pregnant if I got married. So I think that, like, nobody really thought our marriage was going to last, and maybe we didn't know if it was going to last. So having kids was really far from my mind in terms of what our relationship would produce. It was just kind of like, let's get married. This is kind of fun. And then we just had our anniversary. It's been like 12 or 14 years or something.
It's Terry, it's either 12 or 14 years. We're going to get back to you on that.
I mean, don't fact check me, please.
It's actually 12, to be clear.
Okay. So, Jen, what changed your mind and made you think you did want to become a mother?
I don't know if I can put that into words, but I really did feel like there was something that I didn't know that Mike and I would develop, in terms of, like, we developed a really beautiful love, I thought, and our house sort of had a beautiful love to it. And I felt like we had something to offer to a child. And I don't know, it wasn't tumultuous anymore. We just sort of were living this beautiful life. And I felt like Mike would be this amazing dad. And I felt like it was the kind of challenge that we were ready for.
Well, it sounds like you were ready.
I think Mike was ready. He just didn't know it.
So when you realized, Jen, that you wanted to have a baby, did you rehearse how to bring it up to Mike, knowing that he might be resistant to the idea?
I didn't rehearse it, but I just know him so well. So I knew he didn't want to. So I guess, you know, the conversation was like, I know you don't want to have a kid. I totally get it. You're right to feel this way, but I see something different for us. And it was kind of that kind of dialogue.
Mike, did you feel betrayed? Like, we had an agreement where we weren't going to have children. What are you pulling on me now?
Well, I make the point that when she first brought it up, I said to her, I was very clear when we got married that I never wanted to have a kid. And I say, which, by the way, gets you nothing. Apparently being very clear is useless. But it's true. Like, I think it ended up being a series of conversations, I'd say, over months and months. I think I say in the book, like, there was never a moment. There's never a moment in life that creates one big decision. I think it's a series of moments that form an evolution. And I think that's what happened, is over time, I just felt like, well, this is my life partner. This is this person who I love and trust and who I'm going to spend the rest of my life with. And this is really what she wants to do. And I know she'd be a great mom. And so the idea of holding her back at a certain point felt it felt very selfish to hold her back from that. And it was a dilemma. But then, just to come full circle, it's so funny, like, Una's five now, and it's, you know, sometimes people ask, like, what about when Una gets older and she reads this book and all this stuff? And Jen always laughs at that question, because Una is so doted on by both me and Jen that I think for her it would be inconceivable that we would ever have anything less than 1,000% enthusiasm for having a child. And the other thing is that ultimately where the book lands is at this, you know, I don't want to give this away, spoiler alert, if people really want to experience the book exactly in order, but the end is a letter to my daughter saying to her, like, I, you know, this book is for you. Like, I want you to read this book, because ultimately it's about being honest. Like, I'm being, you know, painfully and darkly honest in a way that I think that we should all be to each other, because I think that when you're honest with people who you love, ultimately, even if it's painful in the short term, in the long term, it makes you even closer. And so I don't know if Jen wants to speak to that.
Yeah, I'd also say that You know, Mike voicing all of his concerns for me and the way our relationship works, it actually calms me down and I don't have to wonder what he's thinking. And I think in relationships, sometimes people keep those kinds of fears to themselves and you have to half wonder and the feeling is still in the air, but you can't quite put your finger on it. I don't have to worry about quite putting my finger on it. It's completely like vocalized on a daily basis, you know, so I don't have to yeah. wonder where I stand or where things mm-hmm. stand. And there's some comfort to that for me because I feel like I'm actually not much of a talker. And so for me, it helps comfort me somehow. And so I don't feel so overwhelmed by Mike saying, I don't want to do something and knowing that I do want to do it. I don't feel like we're that far apart because he's so vocal and we can actually talk about it and I'm not wondering about it.
There's a joke in the book where I say, Jen is an introvert and I'm an extrovert. An extrovert is someone who gets energy from being around other people and an introvert doesn't like you. Or she might like you, but she's going to need me to explain why we're leaving the party. But the introvert, extrovert thing that Jen is alluding to, it is like in some ways our dynamic and what she's saying, I think is true. Like, and it's building on what I'm saying, which is like, I grew up in like a Catholic, like a conservative Catholic upbringing in Massachusetts that was very much the opposite of the way that I write, which is it was very sort of like don't, you know, very much don't say how you feel. And it leads, you know, that kind of behavior leads to repression. And I feel like I try to reverse that and maybe I go too far.
Oversharing.
Yeah, exactly.
Jen, you had a difficult pregnancy. You were so thrilled to be pregnant, but you had, in your second trimester, you had a bleeding placenta, which at first you thought was a miscarriage. So I know you were very concerned through the pregnancy that something could go wrong. And then you found out you had hypermobile hips, which meant that during childbirth, you could possibly dislocate or even break a hip. So I want you to read a poem about the pregnancy. And this is a poem called Magic Trick.
Magic Trick. I bled and bled. I thought of friends who have gone through much worse, and I bled. I thought of women across the world and in our own country who have no medical care, and bled. I thought of blood and its magic trick, flowing cell by cell through time without ever leaving the body. How differently it performs than other liquids. Girl, I whisper to my belly before they tell me she's a girl. My body may fail you. Sorry. But know this. Your life belongs to you. And our time together, it has already begun.
Thanks for reading that. And that's one of the poems in Mike Birbiglia's memoir. Mike, were you afraid not only of being a father, but afraid of losing the baby and a fear that Jen might be injured in the process of pregnancy or childbirth?
Yeah, I think that the pregnancy was nerve-wracking throughout. Getting pregnant was challenging. I think Jen can speak to this better than I can, but I feel like the first and second trimester were so challenging, and then there was a point in the third trimester where Jen started. There was a period of time where she was enjoying it, and she started eating like a college freshman, just like hot dogs and ice cream and mayonnaise. And at one point, she's eating like three hot dogs, and she looks up to me and she says, I feel like I understand you now. And I said, I think that's a little bit offensive. That might be the most offensive thing you've ever said to me. But we really did have like a bonding period in the third trimester, but where I feel like in some ways, Jen's pointed this out before, in some ways we were as close in that third trimester as we've ever been. And yeah, but it was scary. I mean, the whole thing was scary, and I was really scared for her. I was scared for Una. You know, it was terrifying.
Were you terrified, Jen?
I was, and I had a mixture of feelings. I was excited, and it was like some days were the greatest days I've ever experienced in my life in some ways. But you know, and what the poem's about too is just like the closeness I was starting to feel with the unborn child because I was so day to day. And so I started to sort of, I feel like be sort of maybe over connected to the child because it felt like any day anything could happen. And so I was very aware of my own struggle and the struggle, her struggle as well. And I sort of felt like I started to have a connection to her early, not knowing if she was going to make it or not. And then, you know, from as far as Mike and I feel like we're very close in this time, and his feelings about not wanting to be a father, I didn't hear that a lot from him. I don't feel like that was part of the experience when I was pregnant. It was more about my health and Una's health. And then once, you know, Una was born, it went back to, it went back to, he did not want to be a dad. He was not ready.
So your baby Una was born, and Mike, the book is about your reluctance to become a father and your lack of connection early on to your daughter. And so you write that after she was born, you were not immediately in love with her. You didn't feel committed to her. And you started trying to figure out how to finance your life with this new child for the next 20 years. Can you talk a little bit about the feeling that you weren't immediately in love with her? Did you think that there was supposed to be this kind of chemical reaction and just automatic sense of wonder about this connection, but you just weren't feeling it? Did you feel like something was wrong with you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in the first 13 months, which is where the book mostly takes place, I felt like all of the things that I had thought, all the seven reasons I never wanted to have a child, I was right about it. And I was like, see, I told you, you know, and it was scary. I mean, I really was. I mean, it was a scary moment in my life. And then what's interesting, though, I will say this, is from performing these stories on stage, I can't tell you how many fathers come up to me, but also, I'd say disproportionately, mothers come up to me and say that they felt exactly the way I did, which was very illuminating for me, this idea of, like, sometimes parents bond with the child at birth or before birth or 6 months into the baby's life or 12 months or a year and a half or whatever it is. And that's not just a you know, not a father thing. It's a parent thing. And I've spoken to actually so many mothers and fathers who've experienced that.
Jen, did you experience that at all? The sense of, I don't feel the connection to my baby that I should be feeling?
No, I didn't experience that. I understand why Mike didn't, and I really understand why other parents might not feel that, but I kind of had the opposite, which is perhaps I was too connected to her, and too, maybe just because I had a rough pregnancy, still like maybe more worried than I should be. And so I think I went the other way, and I think that's part of us being in two different places in that time.
The baby had trouble sleeping at first, and Jen, you're an insomniac, and Mike, you have a really serious sleepwalking problem. You nearly killed yourself a couple of times. And so you were concerned that you could hurt the baby while sleepwalking. So describe what you had to do to protect the baby from your sleepwalking.
This is something that Jen and I spent a lot of time gaming out because... yeah, I mean, my last book, Sleepwalk With Me, I talk about how I sleepwalked through, to be clear to the listeners, through a second story window of a La Quinta Inn in Walla Walla, Washington, almost 15 years ago. And so since then, I take medication. I sleep in a sleeping bag. And with Una coming, we decided that I should just sleep in a separate bedroom and sleep in a sleeping bag. And then to make it even more secure, I invented. I mean, it's not trademarked, but it's a sleep sheet that has a hole in it for my head. And then one for Jen, though she never used it. And then I would lock the door, and I actually put a chain lock on the inside so that I couldn't get out, because I was, you know, and then Mazzy, our cat, would sleep in that room with me. And occasionally she would pee in the bedroom that I was locked in a sleeping bag. So it was not... It wasn't the best surroundings that period of time.
I also wanted to add to that before Una was born, Mike's sleepwalking was a really sort of big issue in our relationship. And it's hard to explain to people how dangerous it is that he actually jumped through a glass window, that he's capable of. What he's capable of doing in his sleep is very different than what he's like in his waking life. And it's really scary. And I was kind of... the person, not in charge of it, but I was like his partner in that. And being so connected to Una, I think took me away from that for a little while. And I usually had such strong tabs on what's going on with Mike's sleepwalking. And it was just very much a part of my day to day. And I was stretched so thin, I kind of let that go.
So Jim, what was it like for you? Mike had to lock himself in the bedroom to protect the baby from his sleepwalking, which meant if the baby woke up, it's all on you.
Yeah, and we had agreed on that because of Mike's sleepwalking issues and because he takes medication at night. We had agreed that I would be in charge of everything at night. And so, yeah, I was exhausted, and Una was a terrible sleeper. And I didn't really see that coming, you know, in my head. I sort of had this idea... I didn't have a lot of fantasies about having a child. I tried not to like put anything on her, you know, before she's born. But one like idea I had is that she would sleep eventually. Like she would, like I would be able to put her down and do a little work while she's asleep. And it didn't feel like that. It was like I had to hold her all the time. And if I ever put her down, she would scream. So she would just sleep on top of me for a long time. And so... That definitely created a lot of distance between Mike and I. And then, you know, he was shooting a film, so during the day he was gone all day. And so I feel like in those months, Una and I, you know, got very close, and Mike hadn't really caught up to the sort of basics of how to sort of raise a baby, you know. So I was really doing most of the things at that point. Diapers, baths, nighttime, everything. So, and you know, and it's not a huge surprise given how he felt about it and sort of all the discussions we had before it, but the actuality of it, you know, created distance between us for sure, because we were growing in different directions.
And Mike, it sounds like you felt that you and Jen were growing apart. Were you afraid the marriage would end?
I was raised by two Catholic parents who have been married for 50 years, despite a really strong case for them not still being married. I don't know a better way to put that. Like I think they love each other, but I also feel like in a different set of circumstances or in a different era, they might not be together. There is a lot of not physical conflict growing up, but it was a lot of verbal conflict that was hard to, you know, it was hard. And so the way I understood marriage, the way I was taught marriage as a child, was that it was forever, no matter what. And so I thought, I'm not going anywhere. But also, you know, Jen had a different upbringing. And so I felt like she... And we've since, this is interesting, Terry, like in writing the book, Jen and I ended up saying things to each other that we didn't say in that period of time. And one of the things is that Jen felt like she thought the marriage might end in that period of time, in that first 13 months with a child. And I didn't know that, but I could feel it. I could really feel it.
Jen, why did you feel the marriage might end?
Well, I thought, you know, we had been together a while, and that was definitely one of the more tumultuous times. And because there was so much distance between us, you know, that's the time period that my parents got divorced. And so it's probably part of my experience that that's something that can happen in that time period if things go that way. And so, you know, I didn't want that, but it occurred to me like, oh, I guess this is the time period that people can get divorced or something like that. And so, and we just hadn't figured things out. And so there was a question of, are we going to figure things out or not? And I guess I didn't know at that point, and I just didn't know if we were going to find each other in that moment or not.
There were body issues for both of you after Una was born. Mike, you had put on weight during the pregnancy and the early time of...
Easy, Terry, please.
Yeah. And I think part of it was, you know, at the end, like, Jen was eating so much that you might have eaten along with her. But also you say, like, you're addicted to food, and I'm sure stress and the stress of the pregnancy and becoming a father just added to that. You'd become pre-diabetic. You know, you had cancer when you were 19. You were just very aware of all the health issues you had. And I think you were feeling that especially after becoming a father. Whereas, Jen, you had to deal with the pain of the after effects of childbirth. But you have a really beautiful poem about, it's called Body, I Never Knew I Could Love You. And it's about all the joy of having had, you know, a baby growing inside you and seeing her in the world. Would you read it for us?
Sure. Body, I never knew I could love you. I never loved my body until she was inside it. I never loved my breasts until they made milk for her. I never understood why people took naked pictures of themselves until she was inside me, the taut and expanding skin over the relentless womb, the anti-gravitational breasts. They are the only naked photos you will find of me on my computer. Release them, I don't care. Release them for science. I'll say it just once and only to myself. I don't want to give up the power to feed my child with my body. I don't want to give up the power to be able to feed my child without a bowl or grain or utensil or dollar or bottle or government, this government, or job or faucet or jar. And on airplanes, we are a smooth operating machine on takeoffs and landings. Passengers come up to me and say, your baby could solve world peace. She's the face of the ceasefire. It scares me to depend completely on the world around us to feed my child. What if we get lost and I forget to pack snacks? What if the economy dives and we have no money for food, or a natural disaster, or the dictator comes to power, or some kind of attack? Or how will I feed her?
Jen, did pregnancy and childbirth and how it changed your feelings about your body, did those feelings remain? Do you feel differently about your body and what it's capable of than you did before you became a mother?
I think so, yes. I mean, I became a mother pretty late in life, and so...
How old were you?
I was 41 when mm-hmm. I became a mom. So I was... I had sort of lived a long time as not a mom. And I don't know. It seems so obvious to me now, but I really wasn't really connected to my body. I wasn't really thinking of myself as a woman or a man. I was just feeling pretty much just like a person. I didn't really understand I just didn't understand something that I felt like once I became pregnant, I understood, like, oh, I'm a woman. And actually, it was kind of like I was experiencing my body for the first time. And then the idea that I could be food to another living thing is something I'll just like never get over. It's just something, because I think it came to me so late in life, it was just kind of shocking. I was like, oh my gosh, I have these capabilities that I didn't even know I had. Now, 5 years later, I do think it sticks with me a little bit. Yeah, I definitely see myself more as a woman than I did before I had a kid.
Mike, how did you start to connect to your baby daughter? What changed things for you?
I feel so silly when I think about this because it's so simple. Is that when she started to talk, I started to understand how she felt. I mean, it's so silly. Like I, there's this chapter in the book where I take Una for pizza on the corner, and Una says, "Pee pee," which I think means pizza and also yes. And I would say, "Do you want?" I'd say, "Una, do you want some pizza?" And she would say, "Pee pee," I'm such a verbal person, and so I think I'm a decent listener, and so I could really listen and understand her, and I still can. Like, she and I are so close now. We just talk and talk and talk, and the verbal communication for me was really profound, and I think for Jen it was the physical relationship was their version of talking.
So they can talk now too.
No, I've cut that off.
Cut that out, yeah.
No, now that I have the upper hand, I've really taken over.
So it's interesting. I've seen this with other parents too. That at first you worry that having a child is going to ruin your work and ruin your career, and then the child somehow becomes the subject of some of it. Like, you have this great book and show that you did as a result of becoming a father, and Jen, you have these great poems about being a mother. So it's just interesting how things change. Speaking of things changing, so you had these long talks before, you know, becoming parents about, you know, Mike's reluctance and Jen, why you wanted to have a child. And I know you couldn't possibly have fathomed that you'd be raising a child during a pandemic, and that the child wouldn't be able to go to daycare or go to school, and that you'd be, you know, teachers and parents, and that Mike, you were worried you wouldn't be able to tour. Well, you can't tour. That decision has been made for you for the time being. And you can't make movies right now. And you can't do your stage show right now. Like, everything is on hold for now. How are you dealing with this new, you know, the feels like forever, change in your lives as parents and as professionals?
We had Una start going to school when she was 1.5 years old, so we really feel it, her not being in school. And I think it's a lot like when we first had her. I feel like the dynamic between Mike and I is probably reminiscent of that time period right now, and for the reasons that you're saying, and that he can't tour. And that it's hard. It's hard. I mean, we have a lot of beautiful family experiences that we're thankful for, but those things are really hard. I mean, I think they're hard for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a live performer as my primary source of income, and a live touring performer, and it's gone. I don't know any other way to put it. It's on hold for a year, and that's we rescheduled our book tour, which was gonna be a 15 or 20 city tour, and it's rescheduled for next spring. And even then, we're looking at those dates and not entirely convinced that that's gonna be the case. And so I created the Working It Out podcast, where I'm basically taking my work and I'm placing it into a live audio format so that I can continue to not only work artistically, but also have a job. And so that's reminded me actually of when I was 23 years old and I was driving my mom's station wagon around the country, cold calling comedy clubs and saying, "Hey, do you want to have me perform at your club?" And the struggle and rejection of that. And so, So it's been hard, but I have to say, like, the silver lining of it, and I've heard other parents say this, is in this period from March through August, if it were not for the pandemic, I would have been on tour and I would have missed some of these milestones from our daughter's age 5, which are astonishing. Like, she'll do a 5-minute monologue to me about dinosaurs, facts about dinosaurs that I do not know, and monologues about rocks and insects, and she's learning to read, and she's learning to swim. You know, like, she was in the ocean the other day, and she got, you know, pummeled by waves in the ocean and then got fell down to the sand and then jumped right back up and said, "More," you know, and and it was awesome. And so it's like, it's been a lot of highs and lows during this period of time.
And, you know, without childcare, you know, Mike and I really don't have a lot of time to spend together alone. And there was one day in all of this where we took a walk, just the two of us, while somebody watched Una distanced. That's how little time we have to just be a couple, you know, but that's what it is.
And then the analogy to the thing that I say in the book is, in the middle of this pandemic where, you know, we're struggling and a lot of people are struggling, is because other people are struggling, you know, exponentially more, we have to say, it's the most joy I've ever experienced. I didn't know what joy was until now, and now I know what it is. It's this. And Jen's pointing out this thing that it is similar to the first 13 months of having Una. And she didn't bring that up to me directly, but sometimes it takes fresh air, Terry, to bring out the truth.
So your next book, Mike, is going to be about death.
And I thought, like, yes.
So this book is about new life, and now you go into death. Why is that going to be the subject?
Well, the new show, which I tentatively have called the YMCA Pool, pending the legal agreement of the YMCA Pool or the YMCA organization, is about how, as a child, I went to the YMCA pool constantly. I went to nursery school there. I took swimming lessons there. And I vowed I would never return to the YMCA. Like, I don't know if it was the chlorine smell or the snack machine room that also sells soup, or the, you know, there's something about, I was like, I just don't want to return. And then here I am in my 40s and I'm back at the Brooklyn YMCA swimming laps, because my doctor says, you know, you're I failed the pulmonary test. I had type 2 diabetes. I've since reversed that, but yeah, I'm trying to live longer, you know. Like, I feel like you get to this age where, I'm 42 now, but you know, they call middle age being over the hill, which I never understood until I got on the hill. And then I looked around and I was like, oh, well, there's natural causes, you know, and like, they're not close, but they're coming. And it's just what I, honestly, it's what I think about is sort of how does this end? And then similar to the new one, I feel like it's a taboo subject. People don't want to talk about death, but yet it's all around us all the time. And then with COVID, of course, I'm going to have to write extensively about how that affects how we feel about death. Because, again, it's all around us. And it's, yeah, I mean, I try to write about the things that we think about, but we're uncomfortable talking about. I feel like if there's a service in what I'm doing as a writer, there may not be a service, but if there is a service, I think that's what it is.
Well, I'm so glad you collaborated on this book. I want to thank you both so much for talking with us and for being so open. And I wish you good luck during this COVID crisis, and good luck with parenting, and Mike, with all the work that's on hold right now that will hopefully resume in the not too distant future. Thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry. Stay safe.
Thanks so much, Terry. We really appreciate it.
Mike Birbiglia's new memoir, The New One, includes poems by his wife, Jen Stein, who writes under the name J. Hope Stein. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, my guest will be former poet laureate Natasha Trethewey. Her black mother and white father had to leave their home in Mississippi to get married because interracial marriage was still illegal there. After their divorce, her mother married a man who turned out to be abusive, and after years of marriage, shot and killed her. Trethewey's new memoir is about her mother and about race. I hope you'll join us.